Hi there, debated listeners, it's Will here. Before we continue, I wanted to tell you about a podcast I'm really enjoying at the moment. We're currently facing one of the most challenging moments in human history. Our governments are under increasing pressure to bring about the results people expect, while remaining trusted and relevant. And yet, the systems, structures, and processes of government today are often not set up to respond to the complex challenges we face as a society. Reimagining Government is a new podcast from the Centre for Public Impact and Apolitical that explores radical new approaches to addressing the most pressing issues of our time. By speaking with public servants and politicians at the heart of government worldwide, it shines a light on how to reimagine government so that it works for everyone. From the climate crisis to equitable healthcare provision and how to rebuild trust with marginalised communities, listen to the Reimagining Government podcast to explore today's most urgent global issues. Don't miss out. Find and follow Reimagining Government on your favourite podcast streaming platforms.
I will work day in and day out. Wake up and smell the coffee.
The independence case is a powerful one.
Another future is possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Hugh Goldborn to discuss the new partnership, the new project between Progressive Britain, Labour Renaissance and Hugh, Fair Competition for Fair Growth. Welcome to the podcast, Hugh.
Good morning, Will. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you on. Now, the first question that I'd like to ask is, could you explain to the listeners who haven't seen it and haven't been engaging with it, what Fair Competition for Fair Growth is and how it started?
Yeah, that's a great question to start with, isn't it, Will? So I suppose to take those questions in reverse order, how did it start? Well, I'm a commercial solicitor based in the north of England, in Huddersfield, in West Yorkshire. And most of my clients are small and medium-sized enterprises. I also, in my spare time, which I don't have that much, because I've also got a family, two young daughters, I'm also involved in the Labour Party and campaign, as we are at the moment, for local elections, etc. And I've done a lot of work in the past on policy, particularly around energy and climate change and those sorts of things. But I'm also a member of our local Chamber of Commerce, so I work a lot with small and medium-sized enterprises. And my local area is really an economy in West Yorkshire of small and medium-sized enterprises, you know, businesses that employ anywhere between 1 and 250 employees. And so, you know, I guess one of the first frustrations I have, Will, is that often discourse about the economy revolves around big, large corporates, doesn't it? You know, the big names that we know, the big supermarkets, the big tech giants like Microsoft have been in the news today and others. And we don't often hear about the smaller organizations, but they're the ones that are intrinsic to our economy, right? They employ more than 60% of people. And in an economy like mine here, it'd be much higher. And they also put a lot of good stuff into our local community. If we think about the people who are rescuing our local football clubs, our local choirs, our local community groups, it's small businesses, right, who invested those, give money. And they're employing local people. They can't just suddenly offshore and go somewhere else, right? If you're a business that's located in a local area, supplying a local area, that's not of interest to you. So they're intrinsic to our local communities, societally and environmentally as well, in terms of what they do. And yet we don't talk about them very much. And they don't really have a voice. There's a reason why they don't have a voice. They don't have, you know, they can't afford to pay lobbyists to sort of sit in Westminster and talk to government ministers or go out in the press and that kind of stuff. So this comes from that sort of frustration. I work with them. I see the fantastic work they do, both in terms of employing people and the contribution they make to our economy, but also to our local communities and to society. And so when I started talking to Progressive Britain and Labour Renaissance, and I am on the steering group of Labour Renaissance, we were quite excited about the chance, I guess, to raise awareness of this nationally, and particularly within the Labour Party. You know, the Labour Party is doing quite well at the moment. I don't think there's any secret to say that they might form the next government. And we want them, if they're forming the next government, to put SMEs front and centre of their economic policies. And but we can see some tensions in that, right? Mm-hmm. One, as I said, large organizations can lobby much more effectively. They have the resource and the opportunity to do that. So we need to do that on behalf of SMEs. And two, you know, the history, I'm a trade unionist. I'm a member of two trade unions. The history of the Labour Party is founded in trade unions, and for good reason, we continue to be highly represented by them. But again, you know, the trade union movement is more public sector now than private sector, if we're honest. And even in the private sector, you know, SMEs generally don't have trade union organisers within them. And so there isn't that natural lobby in the Labour Party, if that makes sense. And so again, we just want to form that lobby. We want to make sure there's a strong voice for SMEs. And we want to do that for all the reasons that I started in. It's a values-based judgment, right? SMEs generally, if we all think of the community, I don't know where you live, Will, but if you think of the community that you live in, it's often the local business owner, isn't it, who is known as by his employees or his or her employees as being a leader in the community. But often that's the person you turn to, isn't it? If your community centre is closing or needs some investment, who can sponsor it? Who can sponsor our local youth football team? Who's going to help the choir out? Who's going to fund the cleanup of the local park? You know, it's often that business leader, isn't it? And so we need them. We need them not just for economic growth reasons, but also for our communities. And so that's why we think it's really important for the Labour Party to put them front and centre of any policy going forward.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And one of the things that really comes across as well is not just that, obviously, SMEs don't have the same kind of lobbying power that larger multinational companies have, but also that they have been perhaps much more impacted by COVID and the COVID pandemic than those kind of organisations. Do you think that it's particularly important, given the economic problems that we're seeing in Britain, both as a result of COVID and as a result of all sorts of other things, for the Labour Party to make sure that it supports small and medium enterprises more now because of how integral they will be to any economic recovery under a potential future Labour government?
The short answer is yes. You're absolutely right. This is front and centre of it, because we can't have this debate in isolation from the economic context that we find ourselves in. You know, we are, I probably don't need to recite some of the macro statistics around this, but we're pretty much at the bottom of, you know, the global giants in terms of economic nations, in terms of things like productivity. Wages are still lagging behind inflation, underinvestment in R&D and other things like that. And so really, yes, I mean, we need to catch up quickly with other nations, and economic growth is probably the only way out of our current, you know, cycle. I mean, I think it was only this week, wasn't it, that the chief economist at the Bank of England said we're all getting poorer and we have to accept it. Well, I'm not sure most people are going to accept that. So growth is well, I certainly wouldn't want to be Keir Starmer saying that at the next general election. So, and I don't suppose Rishi Sunak will be either. So growth, yeah, is going to be front and centre this next general election, isn't it? And to get to growth, and, you know, it's important that we've called this fair competition for fair growth. I think fair growth is front and centre of the Labour Party's manifesto. And so fair competition, I think, is right. And I think when we look at SMEs, both historically and during this period, first of austerity and then going into COVID, they've tended to be, we've tended to put less emphasis on helping those organisations to recover. You know, if we think back to what, 2008-09, there was a huge bailout package that we're still all paying for, by the way. I don't think we talk about that enough. For all of the major banks and financial institutions, there was no such bailout for smaller organizations, you know, organizations employing, say, 100 people in Huddersfield, who also suffered because of the lack of liquidity in the market. Some of them, went under. There was no such support. There was no bailout. So, you know, there's that kind of historic issue around needing to put more investment into local businesses. And you're absolutely right to talk about COVID. I mean, now it's starting to feel quite a long time ago, wasn't it? It's 2020 and we're in 2023. But businesses coming out of that had, you know, they had quite a lot of support. And I think it's fair to, you know, I think we should give credit where credit's due to the Conservative government and the Chancellor at the time, who's now our Prime Minister, that there was support. There were grants and other support mechanisms that were put in to help organisations of all scales through that period. But that has largely dried up now. And so the context that we're going into over the next 12 to 18 months is a world where there aren't those support mechanisms for SMEs and local businesses. And I think the question is, how do you take organisations that have now gone through what a cycle of, it is important to look at this. If you've survived for the last 12 years, you've gone through a liquidity crisis where you probably had to take on a lot more debt to get through that kind of financial crisis period. You've then started to try and do better. There was then the disruption around leaving the European Union and Brexit. Then you've just about recovered from that. You've gone into COVID. Even with the grants, most businesses, and you know, let's, you know, the trouble with SMEs is that they're as wide as they're sort of tall, aren't they? So you've got anything from a quick growth tech business. You know, I've got contacts who run things in digital health that have gone from sort of 10 employees to 150 in the last 3 or 4 years. You've got that kind of business, which actually is doing very well. And we need to put a focus on helping them scale even more. But they're very different challenges to someone who, say, owns two pubs and a coffee shop in the middle of Huddersfield, right? And those organizations are really struggling because they've had to go through all of that period, including COVID, when they couldn't even open. And then now with the decline of high streets, business rates still being relatively high. I know there's been some work on that, but they're still relatively high. Rents very high. Cost of energy skyrocketed, right? Cost of food, cost of everything's gone up. So they're having to wear all those costs in a climate where actually most of us have less money, as the Bank of England have said this week, to spend. So, you know, that's a huge crisis for our high street in terms of retail, leisure, et cetera, et cetera. And so for those businesses, really, I think there's a critical question around what can we do quite quickly to help them, if in both now in terms of the government and what's Labour going to do to help them. And that's, you're right, that's absolutely front and centre around that, is around, yeah, coming out of COVID and what kind of support can be done. Now, I know the Labour Party has talked about potentially more work on rates relief. I think there'll be much more work that's needed to be done, and that's what we've started to do for them. One thing in particular, you know, one of the things we've done is we've started to launch a series of essays. That's the way we're starting to do this, and we are working towards basically putting together a manifesto between Progressive Britain and Labour Renaissance, of, you know, sort of top 10, 20 things that we believe a new Labour government could do in the first 100 days. And I think that's the important thing to say. Quick interventions, not many of them requiring huge amounts of capital, because we start from a place where we understand that, you know, that there might not be that much money in the Treasury. And certainly any money that there is going to probably be needed for public services and other things. So we recognize those challenges. And so what we're trying to say is that there are other mechanisms by which a Labour government can quite quickly intervene and do some interesting things. And if I were to give an example of that, we've talked a lot about the productivity angles, right? Lack of productivity within British business as a whole. Actually, SMEs are are struggling even more than large organizations. So organizations that employ, say, 250 to 999 people, 1,000 people, which are generally not SMEs, larger corporates tend to be more productive, actually, than those that are SMEs, so 250 less employees. In fact, those organizations tend to be 20% less productive than larger organizations. Productivity is normally driven by things around either lack of access to capital, so he's not able to do the sort of research investment in R&D that you might need, or digital investment, right? Or actually employees, fundamentally. You know, one of the challenges I hear all the time from businesses that I work with, advise or help support in other ways, is that they're currently on this treadmill of, you've just about got the workforce you want, some of the users, and you're back into, and that's a good place, actually. Most are even in a worse place, where they've just got, at any one time, 5% of their workforce needs to be filled, right? And so they spend so much time thinking about, how do we get the people we need into our business? And, you know, that's just hampering productivity hugely. So there's a skills agenda, I think, here. And there's also a digital one, an investment in digital, and just helping, and then also helping SMEs to have the access to finance that means that they can make those investments ahead of time, which is what larger corporates are able to do, because they do have much larger balance sheets and often have that profitability that enable them to do that. So that's one of the things that we're encouraging the Labour Party to look at, and look at ways in which they can do that. There are also things in terms of particular regulatory interventions, right? And this is where you really get to the weeds a little bit, but it is important. You know, it's going to be quite important, I think, for whoever's the, you know, Rachel Reeve, Jonathan in Pays and others, whoever goes into those departments to really get into the detail on this. Because if you look at, say, something like competition policy, which is, you'll know, has been in the news today because of the potential acquisition by Microsoft that's been blocked by the Competition and Markets Authority. Fantastic work, by the way, they've done on that. But that's large organizations. There is no real focus within the Competition and Markets Authority or within competition regulators generally in the UK on SMEs. And so one of the things that we're calling for a Labour government to do, and the Conservatives are welcome to do in the next few months as well, is look at that. So one of the first things they could do is every couple of years, they give a strategic steer to the CMA. And one of the things they could put in their next strategic steer, they didn't in 2019 when they last did this, is to encourage the Competition Markets Authority to have a focus on SMEs and actually to come up with a separate strategy for SMEs. So I think that would be one of the first things they could do, and think about how they're going to strengthen SME voice. Now, there is, of course, one organization that particularly represents small and medium-sized organizations in the UK, and that's the Federation of Small Businesses. So they could potentially, they don't at the moment, they could potentially give the Federation of Small Businesses a strategic role, which other organizations have, and in particular a power to make super complaints about areas of competition policy that they think are not working. We think that's something that they could do, that any government could do quite quickly, and would really give that strategic steer and mean that resources are being put into helping SMEs. One of the other things that they could do in relation to that, and one of the things the CMA could do, is retail price maintenance, which is viewed by within competition law, and I'm getting quite technical. I used to be a competition lawyer at one stage, so let me try and explain the best I can. So retail price maintenance is effectively where you fix the price of your goods or your services.
Yeah,
and you might do it with, I might do it with another business that's a competitor, right? Now, that is generally seen as anti-competitive for good reason. You know, if Microsoft and another provider of that scale were to get together and fix prices, that would be quite difficult. You know, Microsoft and Google all sat in a room and decided how they're going to price things. That would create an artificial pricing mechanism. That's not good for consumers and it's not good for economies. But actually, there's a lot of evidence that shows that where Pub A and Pub B, or small manufacturer A and small manufacturer B, do that, it can actually be quite a good thing, because A, it's not big enough to really affect consumers. You know, if you don't like that pub, you can go to another one somewhere else, or those two pubs. Yeah. If you don't want to buy off that medium-sized manufacturer of beds, well, there's hundreds of others around the world, right, that you can, or thousands of others. But actually what it allows those businesses to do is to have some certainty about pricing, such that they know how much profit they're going to have for a period of time. And that allows them then to build up the reserves that they need to invest in the things that we just talked about, make them more productive. So actually it can be pro-competitive, because it enables those organizations to grow, to develop, to invest, and to give a better output. And of course, do all the things we talked about before in terms of investing in employees and other things. And it's not just us saying this. There's a lot of academic work that's been done on that. And it's working in other jurisdictions. So the US, for example, their competition authorities have a regime that ensures that they have a distinction between larger organizations who impose retail price maintenance, which is illegal, and smaller organizations where they look at is that actually causing harms, you know, what I just said. So if there's no real harm to the local economy or to the wider economy, then it's fine, you should do it. It might actually be pro-competitive, actually. If there is harm caused, then yeah, it's illegal and you shouldn't do it. But they look at it as a harms-based, whereas in the UK, we actually say any form of retail price maintenance is illegal and you'll be fined and severely reprimanded for it. Just one example, I know it's in the weeds a little bit, but it does show that, you know, there are things that you could do relatively quickly that would really unleash the benefits and encourage growth and stimulate investment by those organisations.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned the essays that have been released as part of the project, and one part of Saif Miller's essay particularly took my eye, in which he advocates for childcare to become tax-free. How much of an impact do you think that that would have on the economy, and what impact do you think it would have on parents who need help with childcare, need that support, and perhaps haven't been able to get it?
Yes, no, you're right. And that's one of our really, I guess, most radical papers. I've spent, as it's CF Miller and I've worked quite a lot with the local car dealership. And so coming out of that, we've had many quite deep conversations actually about tax in particular, interesting, and that element of policy. Mm-hmm. And it's quite interesting because this paper, I think, is particularly radical actually, and challenges, I think, quite a lot of the orthodoxies around tax policy and some of the assumptions about, you know, the fault lines between, say, left and right, Labour mm-hmm. and Conservatives. In particular, I noticed that he quoted Adam Smith, who I think generally would be quoted more by conservative mm-hmm. commentators. But actually, he's quite right, and I don't know if you've read Adam Smith. He's quite right to quote Adam Smith, because actually, Adam Smith came from a quite progressive background, mm-hmm. and if you read the fullness of his works, actually, is fairly progressive, right? It's just that some elements have been accentuated, perhaps, by conservatives since the time of Margaret Thatcher. Okay. So, I think what you said is absolutely right, in that childcare at the moment is in that debate we just had around productivity. It's a very, very material point, isn't it? In that, mm-hmm. as you try and get people back into work. And I know this very well at the moment as a parent. There becomes an inevitable discussion in a family around what, depending on your income levels, whether there's any real value going back into work, right? And actually, if we think about it from a business perspective, it's something that they want to support families to do, so they can get people back into the workplace, right, mm-hmm. and then help progress them. So. Absolutely, I think, you know, we could really help more people back into work, help address the productivity challenge, ensure more equality and fairness in the workplace, you know, in terms of gender equality and other things, ensuring that people can get back into the workplace, particularly women. And I think that's really, really critical. The government, as we know, has said they're going to do something in, I think it's 18 months' time, isn't it, back mm-hmm. end of 24. I think, as CF said in his paper, it's a shame that we have to wait that long when we can do something now. The way it's currently administered, sort of working families tax credit and universal credit, is expensive, time consuming. I think lots of audits have shown that it's riddled. There's some fraud elements and other things. You know, the amount we spend, I think, each year is about 12 billion on child benefits. Bit less, I think, about 8.5 billion on personal tax credits, but we only spend 500 million on tax-free childcare. And so really, I think fundamental to his point, first thing, is that a lot of our credits don't provide free childcare. They penalise low-income families who want to work, which is exactly where, you know, I think Labour wants to be in terms of helping low-income families into work. And they don't really reward working more. They kind of might reward working less to some extent. And, you know, I think there's been lots of debates on that where families come from. I've listened to them on Radio 4 and others where families have said that they actually want a system that actually gives them access to high quality, affordable childcare and enables them to go into the workplace, if that makes sense. So I think CF's idea was, given that most parents want to work, we could help them by giving them more choices. You know, could we cover up to 48 hours per week free childcare up to primary school age? And his analysis is that, you know, because you know, most people have, I think, full-time jobs of 30 hours per week, including, say, commuting. And then I guess there's also the wraparound support as well. So his analysis that you could fund this by reallocating some of the spending above, which is approximately, I think it's about 20, 21 billion per year for free childcare. And so effectively all he's talking about, and this has real resonance, I think, of some of the stuff that was done before the last Labour government came in mm-hmm. since the mid-1990s. This is a question of how you spend the existing money that's spent on the system in a much more efficient way. So you take exactly that 20, 21 billion that's already spent and allocate it in a far more efficient manner to effectively help those families that need it the most, rather than having a system which at the moment seems to defeat itself. That makes sense. And so and I think that's reflective of quite a lot of the recommendations that he's made. I mean, I thought I you're right, that childcare one was very interesting. I thought the corporation tax recommendations were very interesting, in that in effect there what he's saying is, why not have a corporation tax system that's more reflective of the personal tax system? You know, we know in our income tax that the grades, certain people, you know, up to a certain level now, it's gone up just above 10,000, a bit more than 10,000, you know, it's tax-free, and then you go into brackets above that. Now, you don't have that in the corporation tax system, so you don't have SMEs exempted from a certain amount of corporation tax, and they're all paying the same level. We know it's now gone up as well. And this debate around corporation tax is probably a bit too binary, in that it could be that we're putting up corporation tax on the largest organizations to a much higher level, perhaps even reflective of personal tax levels for those highest earners. Mm-hmm. And those that have less turnover or smaller profits, which I think it should be profit-based, I guess, because that's your real income rather than your turnover, those would incur smaller rates of corporation tax. And his analysis, I thought, was really interesting, because often the narrative about corporation tax is you reduce it and the economy grows. His analysis shows that actually where we've reduced it, the economy hasn't grown faster, and where we had slightly higher, actually, I think it was around 30% corporation tax during the 2000s, we actually had a pretty steady rate of growth, which is around the growth that we want, which is about 2.6%. So it's I think that was quite important, because I think it's important for any policy to be evidence-based, and some of this becomes a narrative rather than actually being based on truth, doesn't it? So I thought that's very interesting, and I think that those recommendations, the full suite of them, you're right, the childcare recommendations, the ones he's made on corporation tax, he's talked about some personal tax reforms as well that would obviously help employees, all of which through the lens of, and also pensions, and he's also reinforced some of the stuff around windfall tax that that the Labour Party, I think, have been talking about. I think all of those things show that there's just a relative reorganization, actually, doesn't have to be a completely radical change, would enable much greater fairness in the system, but all against the lens of actually that enables your economy to grow. It enables small and medium-sized enterprises to become more efficient, more productive, employ more people, put more money back into the economy. It can pretty much be revenue neutral to the Treasury. So we're not talking about, this is a choice between growing business and economies and public services, which seems to be the debate that we always have. You can have both, but this is about radically changing the balance of where you put your investment in business.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I'd just like to turn to Andrew Dyson's paper, because one of the things that stood out to me in what he wrote was in relation to the tie between encouraging new businesses and regional and local strategy. So he suggests that, you can see certain clusters of particular types of specialised businesses in particular areas, and that can, of course, have a great impact if you encourage them on local and regional economies. Do you think that this is something that could be effective both on a regional scale and also on a national scale, as it were, in that you could identify areas where these businesses need a particular type of support, whether it just be plain capital or other types of support like improved infrastructure, that kind of thing. And that could help not just level up particular areas, but also contribute to growing the economy of the country overall.
Yes, good. Yeah, great question. I'm glad you've highlighted that. And I thought you were going to get through without saying the words levelling it up, but you did say because, yeah, I think front and centre of that that proposal ties into, yeah, regional strategies, doesn't it? And then what has been termed levelling up. But what I might just call, you know, making sure no community is left behind, right? Mm-hmm. I'd say, you know, if we're honest, we haven't yet seen the full flavour of this from the current Labour, from Bench. I'm sure it'll come out nearer to the election. And so this ties into that, right? In that, some of Andrew's paper is about fast growth startup businesses, and there is no doubt that they play that sector or subsector is going to play a very important role in growth in our economy, particularly because of where we are in the race to net zero and the kind of digital 2.0, even 3.0 now, I guess, with AI and the new stuff that's coming through, right? And we need to, at the moment, the UK, I don't think just Andrew, but others would have made this critique, is lagging behind, right? Because other nations have put, the US, I think, is the exemplar, but the European Union is doing it as well. China has done it for a long time, and others are putting a real focus on competition, almost at the, where we're almost exiting the age of globalization, aren't we, and going back into kind of a competition between national economies and protectionism. Well, I don't want this to be a debate about that, but that's where we are, right? And so in the US, they are taking a regionalized strategy. They're saying in Pennsylvania, we're going to go from coal mining before and other industries that have been dying for years. And we're looking at, you know, how you make processor chips, or, you know, is this going to be are we just going to generate loads of solar energy here, you know, et cetera. And so really, I think Andrew's paper starts to flesh that out to some extent, doesn't it? In that he's saying, both in terms of those fast growth clusters. So, you know, we've already got some in the Northwest. We already have stuff around the med tech industry, pharmaceuticals, which we know for some quite high profile examples recently starting to decline. How do you refire that? I've got a client over there who does some very interesting stuff in that sector. Exactly that sort of organization's gone from startups now into scale up. The question all the time from that organization is investment, you know, the rounds of investment they have to go through, but constantly up against challenges, right? Mm-hmm. And I think his recommendations, I think Andrew's recommendations on, can government start to almost look like a kind of private equity style investor itself? I think that's really interesting, taking an equity stake, putting investment in, but probably at a very different level of risk, right, to private equity. Generally want double-digit returns, which is quite high, right? So, you know, that's a very interesting model. I think you raised absolutely the point around infrastructure. Here in West Yorkshire, we have a regional, for the last couple of years, we've had a devolved mayoralty. Tracy Braben, our mayor, I'm sure you've heard her going on about buses, and transport. And I can absolutely tell you one of the biggest barriers to productivity is the amount of time you spend driving around at the moment. You know, access to public transport is very limited. We have one train line. It does go through my town of Huddersfield and neighbouring towns of Dewsbury and to some extent Batley and into Leeds and Manchester. But, you know, trains are over capacity, they're not particularly reliable, those are the only places you can get to, right? I mean, our economy is far more complicated than that. And we have a motorway, the M62, that's well over capacity as well. In between that, you've got A roads that were designed for 100 years ago for cart and horses, right? They were designed for lots of carts. So in gridlock, by analogy, I remember living in London in the sort of late 1990s, early 2000s, when it was a very similar situation. You would never imagine that now in London. I mean, the investment that's gone in, that means you can get a bus, a tube, whatever, you know, all interoperably, is incredible. And that drives that connectivity between business, between investors, between higher education institutions, et cetera, and principally for people. It means people can get around, meet each other, get into work, do stuff. And that makes it an attractive place to invest. It makes business able to connect with each other fundamentally. Now, we just do not have that here in the north of England. And so, it's not just the north of England, it's other parts of England. So I think absolutely investment in infrastructure is really important. And Andrew has made that point. And then you do see the clusters emerge. I think his final point is sort of well made, I think, around how you create tax and other incentives that pull investors out of. I mean, Andrew, as you know, comes from an investment background, and I think, you know, we've consistently seen, and I don't think anyone's yet broken this challenge, but he's at least inviting us to think more about it. How do you pull that trillions of pounds that's invested in the kind of London, what's called the Golden Triangle, isn't it? London, yeah. Cambridge, Oxford. How do you recreate that in other parts of the country? Because there's no doubt that in addition to the sort of infrastructure investment and the people being able to connect with each other, the businesses being able to connect, there is also a question around how do you have enough liquidity to take the risk on both, not just on startups, but on SMEs. And I'll finish with that point. I mean, there's one of the networks I belong to. I was just talking last week to an organization that's been around for quite a long time. So this is why, I mean, it's not just about startups, but a very good business, one of the larger independent auto traders and secondhand car dealerships in the country. And their constant problem at the moment, and this ties back to your point, Will, about post-COVID, is, you know, the car market, secondary car market, has changed entirely since COVID. And I'm sure you're familiar with this, you know, the costs because the supply chain was broken, but also because of regulatory changes, the switch to electric, the fact that public transport switched off to a certain extent, et cetera, has just driven that market. And also the macro point that now there are some very big players that have come into this that are vertically integrated, that are both secondary car market, they also have digital presence, they also do a lot of the investment into that. It's a really hard, all of that makes it a really hard environment for independents. But independents are really important because they create that competition in the market, and they are, for all the reasons we talked about, local, they employ local people, etc. Now, the issue he keeps saying to me is, we can live with a world where it costs more to buy the cars, and so it takes longer to buy them, get them in, sell them. We can live with all of that. We can live with increases in costs of energy, employer increase, etc. But the biggest problem is the lack of liquidity. In competition with those larger organizations that have huge amounts of venture capital in them, which means that they can take speculative positions, right? So they can buy thousands of cars, even if they know some of them they're probably paying way too much for. And then it means they can turn those cars over. And it's the turnover of the cars that is the secondary car market, right? That's what makes you money.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas he, because of the increased costs, et cetera, and the fact that his liquidity hasn't gone up, the banks are not lending to him more. In fact, they're probably lending less to him if he wanted it. And also, on his balance sheet, he doesn't have that liquidity, right? He can't do that. And that's what's killing that market, is that they just cannot get enough liquidity to buy enough cars to make that model work. And that's a very good example of what Andrew's talking about, where actually, is there a position the government could take, or a kind of Northern Bank funded bank or whatever, that says, yeah, okay, we can see there's a problem with liquidity in that market for independent businesses, SMEs. Let's inject some liquidity. Let's give them some money. Let's take even negative stake in that business and give them £1 million that they can just go and invest, because we know it's just such low risk as well, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a model that's existed for 20 years. So I say that because I think, you know, it's important to give a flavor of the different industries, because there are so many different industries and they all have slightly different challenges. But Andrew's point is very well made.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. We're coming towards the end of the podcast, Hugh. Thanks once again for taking the time to speak to me. But I do have one final question for you. We're coming up to a bank holiday. It's going to be a bank holiday this coming Monday. And of course, on bank holidays, people like to spend time just, you know, if they're able to, relaxing and maybe catching up on things. So my final question to you is this. If you had to spend a bank holiday afternoon with any cricketer from the history of cricket, who would you spend a bank holiday afternoon with?
Ah, right. Wow, what a good question, hey? And you'll probably know that I used to play cricket and run a local cricket club here in Huddersfield. So, cricket is very important to me. I'm at risk of failing Norman Tebbit's cricket test here, aren't I? In that, I spent some time in the Caribbean as a youngster, and my dad is from Jamaican heritage. Mm-hmm. My mum from Indian and Kenyan. So I'm at risk of offending someone, in all of this. I'm going to cheat slightly, I suppose, and say I would love to. Well, there's 11 players, isn't there, in cricket?
Yeah.
So I'd like to spend time with at least three of them. And I'd probably say from the West Indies, it would be Viv Richards. I always thought he was a fantastic batsman and had some really interesting stories. From India, you'd have to have, Sachin Tendulkar. So then I've got two great batsmen. I know at least we can get some runs at the top of the order. In England at the moment, I really like some. Well, I don't know if you saw the series on Netflix recently, which had Brendan McCullum and Phil Tufnell.
Yeah,
I thought they had some fantastic conversations, particularly around mental health and other things. So I'd invite both of them as well. I'd love to get them both together. And I think Brendan McCullum would. I know he's a New Zealand cricketer, but he'd have some interesting stuff to say about what he's doing with England at the moment. So yeah, those would be my four. I know I cheated slightly. Those would be my four.
No. You're more than welcome to cheat. I think those are fantastic choices. Thank you once again for taking the time to record the podcast with me. If people want to find out more about you and more about Fair Competition for Fair Growth, where should they go to find out more?
We're featured on both the labourrenaissance.org.uk and Progressive Britain websites. There's also been an article that we put out on Labour List last week. And if they want to find out more about me, it's Hugh Goldbourne. HughGoldbourne.com is my website.
Fantastic. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast.
Lovely. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, @DebatedPodcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast, or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.